When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I decided that I wanted it to be darkly funny and fairly epigrammatic and witty. I wanted it to be screwball noir. And I handed it in confident that they would say, this is a load of bollocks. And and my surprise, they all liked it. I think that's the story of writing it, essentially.
Welcome back to Light the Fuse presents The Directors. That's right, The Directors, where each week we talk to a filmmaker who has made an iconic and important film in the Paramount Library. We pick their brain. We dissect the film in forensic detail. Charles Hood joining me, Drew Taylor, for this investigation. How are you feeling, Charles?
I feel great, Drew. This is just fabulous. I'm so excited to share this conversation with everybody because you know I adore the movie Clue. It is one of my absolute favorite movies.
Yes, we all know that, Charles. We hear about it all the time. You bring it up whenever you are out and about.
Yeah.
So yeah, we talked to Jonathan Lynn, who directed Clue. And it's a very good time, I feel like, to talk to him because all these people are discovering Clue and the 4K Blu-ray that Shout Factory put out recently, completely sold out, just like the Oppenheimer 4K disc. Gone. Totally wiped from shelves. You and I both got it. We watched it. We loved it. So I feel like this is just like a perfect time to talk to him about Clue and the legacy of Clue. Wouldn't you agree?
I do. Yes, I do. I mean, it's just, we were both lucky enough to get that Shout Factory 4K disc, and we both watched it before we talked to him, and this is just, having a great time having this conversation with Jonathan Lynn, so it's awesome. And we get into some other things in his career as well in part two, but this is just part one this week.
So it's all Clue, all for you, is what you're trying to say to me right now, Charles.
It is indeed.
All right, well.
Oh, but you know what? Actually, before we get started, we should let everybody know who Deborah Hill is, because we talk about Deborah Hill a lot in this.
Well, as we should. Okay, so Deborah Hill is an amazing producer, perhaps best known for her collaborations with John Carpenter, who she was also married to, including movies like The Fog and Halloween. She sadly passed away a few years ago, but from all accounts was just an absolute dynamo, a great sense of story, kept the productions really running smoothly, and she produced Clue.
Yeah.
So
she was also a writer as well. She co-wrote Halloween, co-wrote The Fog, co-wrote Halloween 2.
Yeah.
Her producer credits are amazing. And not only had she produced those John Carpenter movies, she also produced The Dead Zone, which is one of my favorite David Cronenberg movies, right before she did Clue as well.
Another Paramount classic.
Yeah.
Did we talk to David Cronenberg?
Not yet.
But
maybe someday.
Maybe one day. Yeah. Maybe we'll run into him in Canada. But yes. Deborah Hill is just amazing. Look her up. See all the amazing movies she touched in various ways. And this was such a thrill to talk about her to Jonathan Lynn. So thank you for that warm up, Charles. Should we just get right into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
We are so thrilled to be joined by the one and only Jonathan Lynn. How are you doing, sir?
Not bad, thank you.
Okay, good, good. Well, our primary discussion today is going to be around Clue, obviously. I was actually curious what the writing process was like and what it was like working with Landis. How much did he bring to this project? What can you remember?
Well, it's a long story.
We're here for it.
I was approached about writing a film based on a board game, which I thought was the craziest idea I'd ever heard. And I had played Clue when I was a kid, you know, so I knew what it was. But I couldn't see the point of making a film of a board game. However, I was free at the time that Peter Goober approached me. He was in London. And I thought, well, he invited me to go to California and meet John Landis and Deborah Hill. And so I decided I would, because I'd never flown first class, and I thought that would be great. And I also thought, you know, I've never been to L.A., and I thought that would be interesting. And, you know, it'll be a pleasant week. So I went over there with no great hope of anything. I met John, and he was charming and very friendly, and he had a rough idea for the story, which I later learned he had pitched to Tom Stoppard, Stephen Sondheim, Tony Perkins, a whole variety of people. I didn't know at that time, but I was about the sixth writer that they had tried. So his pitch was pretty fluid. And he told the story very roughly, running around the office, jumping on the furniture, shouting.
Was he acting it out? Like, was he like Tim Curry?
He was acting it out.
He was like Tim Curry in the movie?
He was acting out his story. And it was pretty funny. And finally, he got to the moment when he said, the butler says, I know who did it. So I said, well, who did? And John said, I don't know. That's why I need a writer. So I realized that what John had given me was a sequence of unrelated events with no explanation. So it was like, it was a part of the story, and a lot of the stuff that he pitched was in the eventual script. But reasons had to be found for everything. So I went back to my hotel. They put me up at the Chateau Marmont, which was a bit of a dump in those days. And I phoned my agent and said, these people are nuts. I think I'd like to come home now. And he said, well, now you're there, why don't you try and think of something? So I, next day I went in and I had a few very simple thoughts, which I think, you know, my memory is vague about this, it's 40 years ago. But I think it was the fact that these characters are all called colors, but that's all they are. They're not characters. There's Miss Scarlet, Colonel Mustard, Mr. Green, and so on. And how come everybody in this film has a name which is a color? And it seemed to me that they therefore had to be aliases. And they had to be aliases given to them by the person who invited them. And there had to be some reason why they had all chosen to come. So John was very pleased with this and immediately hired me to write the script. So I went home with his half a page pitch, and maybe it was even three quarters of a page, and my very few notes that I'd had in the middle of the night at the Chateau Marmont. And I had to start writing this thing.
Was the plan there right from that point already to have multiple endings?
Apparently, what I discovered as we went along was that the plan was this. The Parker brothers, who owned the board game, had insisted that all nine rooms were used in the film. All the characters in the board game, all the weapons in the board game. So I was in a sort of straitjacket. Oh, because I had all these ingredients, but no sense to any of it. What was the question you just asked me?
Oh, just about the multiple
endings. Oh, the multiple endings. Yes, that had been thought of apparently way before I was involved. I don't know. I don't think it was Deborah Hill. I don't know who it was that thought of this idea. But whoever it was, everyone was very excited about it. I think because they thought it would be something either that replicated the board game in that the ending came out different every time. Although it was mainly, I think, their interest was that it was a way of attracting audiences to the film, not once, but four times. So they would go each time to see a separate ending. When one thinks back on that, that's about the dumbest idea there ever was. Nobody goes to see a film three or four times just to see a different last 2 minutes. But anyway, yes, that was part of my brief. So I then had to sit at my desk and come up with a way of plotting the story so that it was possible for there to be four different endings, which made sense with what the audience had already seen. So I realized the only way to do that was that certain people would have to be off camera. The killer in each ending, or killers, would have to be off camera at key moments committing the crime. So that was the next thing that had to be worked out. And that, of course, was very complicated, not only to work out, but when it came to shooting. It precluded improv, for instance, by definition almost, because I couldn't think through the implications of all four endings. At a moment, somebody said, well, can I do this instead? So the script was pretty tight by the time we came to shoot it. But anyway, I wrote the first act quite fast. That was the arrival of the people, getting as far as the dinner table. And then it was, I don't know, a long time while I tried to work out what Hollywood calls act two. And then I wrote act three, which is Wadsworth's explanation of everything and the endings, quite fast at the last minute before I handed the script in. And I thought, I decided that I wanted it to be darkly funny and fairly epigrammatic and witty. I wanted it to be screwball noir. And I handed it in confident that they would say, this is a load of bollocks. And and my surprise, they all liked it. I think that's the story of writing it, essentially.
We'll be back with more from Jonathan Lynn after the break.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game. Headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
So just while we were talking about the multiple endings, so, you know, for anyone who doesn't know that in theaters, there was a different ending. You could go, you know, in the afternoon, it would have one ending, and you could go later that night and it would have a different ending. There were three different endings that played.
I don't think it was. No, I think one theater had ending A, another theater had ending B.
Right. Okay. So, but if you went to a different theater, right. But you wouldn't know which ending you were going to get. I think some places they listed it was ending A, ending B, ending C.
That didn't mean anything to people, ending A, ending B. Nor to me.
Right. But first time I saw the movie was, my friends and I, this is like 25 years ago or something, we went to Blockbuster, we rented the movie, we, you know, had never seen it before, we were all blown away, thought it was the funniest thing ever. You've got all three endings combined there for home video. Was that always the plan, to put them all together like that, or was that sort of a reaction?
No, that was a reaction to the fact that it didn't open well. And I felt all the way through post-production that this plan of multiple endings was a mistake, because the ingenuity of the story, I mean, there are lots of other, I think, funny things in the film and interesting things, but the ingenuity of the construction lies in the fact that it can come out in multiple ways and all make sense.
Right.
The only way you can appreciate that ingenuity is if you put them all together.
Right.
So when the film didn't do well when it opened, and it was very soon after that, it was time to do the TV version, I said, I'm going to put them all together. And I think that was probably what made the difference, why people started really enjoying it.
I mean, yeah, it was such a mind-blowing thing to watch that at the end where it says, you know, well, it could have happened this way, but or it could happen this way. You know? I just, yeah, my friends and I, when we saw that movie, that's one of my most unforgettable movie watching, movie renting experiences. My friends and I were just howling. It was just the best experience.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
There was a fourth ending, though, right, that you filmed.
There was a fourth ending and we shot it, but it just wasn't very funny. It wasn't that interesting. And I just thought, three is enough. So I just cut it. And I don't remember. Apparently, people tell me that they know what was in the fourth ending and it's online somewhere, but I don't remember what it was.
It wasn't good enough to remember, apparently.
Well, you know, it is 40 years ago.
That's true.
Can you talk about working with the producer Deborah Hill, the late great Deborah Hill?
Yes, I loved Deborah. She was really nice. She had the original idea for the film, I'm told, and had brought it to, I think, Goober and Peters, and then to John Landis. And she was very helpful as a line producer, as we when we started to set it the whole thing up and build this gigantic set on Paramount's biggest stage, and it was a stage where Hitchcock shot. Rear Window, built the whole of that apartment building, an enormous stage. And I don't think she recommended John Lloyd, who designed it, but she knew him and she recommended Vic Campo, who shot it. And she was just generally enormously helpful, especially in the casting, because I'd never worked in America, never cast anything. And so most of this cast, who were quite well known in America, were unknown to me. And so she got lots of funny people in to meet me. I mean, obviously some didn't come, some read the script and said, no, thank you. But others were interested. And of the ones who came in, I just chose the ones who seemed most in tune with it. But the Deborah was very helpful on that. And then all the way through the shoot, she was extremely, I mean, she was a lovely person to work with.
Were there any cast members you tried for that you couldn't get that you can name now?
I'm trying to think now. At one point, I think they tried for Elizabeth Taylor for Miss Scarlet.
Wow.
And you know, I don't remember who we didn't get. I remember there being a lot of actors who wanted to be in it. And I felt I had pretty wide choice of all the people who had expressed interest.
Right.
I can't remember anyone who we tried to get and it. I wanted, I suggested to Paramount that we got Rowan Atkinson to play Wadsworth the butler. And they'd never heard of him. He was a big star in England.
Right.
And I actually persuaded him to send a demo tape. And I don't think Paramount ever watched it, but anyway, they certainly weren't interested.
Wow.
Well, how did you wind up with the cast that you did? I mean, this is a pretty amazing
Yeah.
collection of people. And even like Jane Wineland, I forgot that she played the singing telegram
Yes.
girl. Did she ever actually sing in an earlier cut?
Well, she did. She sang Your Sister Rose is Dead. Isn't that what she sings in the movie?
No, she kind of opens the door and gets murdered right away.
No, she sings I
Oh, I'm
am
your
your
singing
singing
telegram.
telegram.
Yes,
that's
bang. That's right. Well,
right.
that's what she sings.
Right.
One of the many moments that my friends and I just we had to rewind over and over again watching these hilarious moments.
That's very nice. You probably remember them better than I do. Yes, I mean, they were an incredible cast. I knew very few of them. I was a big fan of Madeleine Kahn because I'd seen her in Mel Brooks films and Peter Bogdanovich films. When I heard she was interested, I rewrote the part of Mrs. White a little bit to make it more suitable for her. Tim Curry, I'd known all my life. We were at school together. I knew him since I was 14. And you know, he'd been doing some extraordinary things on stage and on film. Of course, Rocky Horror Show and things. I don't think I knew any of the others. Christopher Lloyd I'd seen in Taxi, not Back to the Future, that hadn't come out yet. Michael McKean I'd seen in Spinal Tap. But I mean, I really wasn't very familiar with any of their work. No, they're just people who came in and I loved talking to and I found them funny. And I don't remember whether I asked them all to read or not.
Right. Well, we actually interviewed Leslie Ann Warren because, you know, we've done over 200 episodes about Mission Impossible. She was a Mission Impossible cast member of the old TV show. She is amazing in the movie. I think she told us, or I've heard before, that Carrie Fisher was going to play that part.
Yes. Carrie Fisher was going to play that part. I hadn't, Leslie Ann Warren had not been thought of, really. And Carrie was going to play it. And then she was very, very funny when I met her. And so I met her the following week in a LA restaurant. And she arrived and fell over a chair and explained, sniffed a lot and said she had very bad hay fever. And being a gullible Englishman, I believed her. So anyway, and nothing more happened on that until shortly before we started rehearsals, when she phoned me and said, I can't come into rehearsal because I'm in rehab, but you know, I'll be there to film it. I can come out to film. And I said, how? She said, well, I'll be here at night and, you know, I'll come out during the day. So I went and told Deborah Hill that, and Deborah seemed to think that was possible. And then we went and told Dawn Steele, who was president of Paramount, and she didn't have a problem with it. And then the insurance company stepped in and said, no way, she's in rehab, and we're not doing that. So there was, I think, 4 days before we started rehearsing, and John Peters mentioned his ex-wife, Leslie Ann Warren. And so I talked to her, and I thought she'd be wonderful in a completely different way.
Right.
And she was. I mean, she gives a really tremendous performance in Clue. And I loved working with her. But she came in very much at the last minute.
How much rehearsal did you have with everybody?
I think it was about a week, but it may have been a bit longer. I've been a theater director for years, so the rehearsal process struck me as very important, and especially on this film, because it would really be a nightmare if people walked onto the set and said, why am I here? What's my motivation?
Right.
I could have dealt with that with all those principal characters who were rightly confused about the story. So we rehearsed it all, and I showed them Howard Hawks's film, This Girl Friday, which I think is one of my favorite films. And I said, I wanted to go at this speed. Very fast.
Yeah.
And they loved that. They took up the challenge. And so we shot it very fast. In fact, sometimes I think a little too fast for people to get all the jokes. But happily, people seem to be watching it several times now. And so I think they get the jokes sooner or later. And then we rehearsed everything. We rehearsed every scene. And there was a huge help to me as well as to the actors, because I'd never made a film before. And so I essentially learned how to place the camera.
We'll be back with more from Jonathan Lynn after the break. How much did the script change from the rehearsals, if at all?
From the rehearsal, I would say essentially not. There were two or three drafts with small changes before that. The only big change was Madeline Kahn's speech about the flames on the side of my face, which was an improv. She said, can I improv this? And I thought, I can't see why not. I mean, we're at the end of the film now. There can't be any implications here. So I said, but as long as you agree to shoot what I've written, well, you can shoot what you want to say. So she improv that, and it was so funny. We never shot whatever it was I wrote. And Michael McKean thinks he came up with the last line of the movie. Maybe he did. I thought I remembered writing it.
Right.
When he said, now I'm going home to sleep with my wife.
Right.
I don't remember whether he improv that in rehearsal or whether I'd actually written it, but it certainly was written in the shooting script.
Right.
I think that's about all the improv there was.
So you're in this situation shooting this movie with these incredibly hilarious, brilliant comedic actors.
Yeah.
And you're having to fight every day to say, you have to stay, we have to stay on script. We have to stay exactly on script because it's such a precise thing where you have to make sure the endings work. Or did everybody understand that and it was okay and they knew that going in?
There was no fighting about it. Everyone was.
Okay, that's good.
Everyone was. The real thing, the actors were having such a good time with each other off stage. There was a lot of games in the billiard room, and there was just a lot of, it was all a very good humor set. And Michael McKean, actually, mostly, but me, sometimes I had to run and say, this is serious. This is about a murder. You are in danger. Because they were all so jolly, and we were doing it.
We interviewed the great, great, amazing costume designer, Michael Kaplan,
yes,
who we adore and is somehow still underrated. And he did incredible costumes for this movie. Can you talk about working with him on these costumes?
Yes, of course. I didn't know him before. Like, I didn't know any of the people I was working with, being a stranger from London. The conversations that we had were chiefly that I said, they're named after colors, but that's their alias, and they should not be dressed in the color of the character. So Miss Scarlet should not wear scarlet. Mr. Green should not wear green. And he totally agreed with that. And then we talked about who the characters were a bit. And then he went off and designed these wonderful costumes. And I didn't really have anything much more to do with it except to see the finished results and say, oh, I love that. That was my main contribution to the costume design, I think.
Did you bring him on after, you know, seeing his work in Blade Runner or something? Or how did he get brought onto the project?
I can't remember. I'm sure Deborah Hill recommended him. But I had seen Blade Runner, but it's so different.
Yeah.
I was very much in Deborah's, and to some extent, John Landis's hands. John was still an executive producer. You know, they made recommendations. They said, we think so-and-so would be good. And I would say, okay, let's meet.
Right.
So the cast did all get along, because sometimes you hear stories of comedians with different styles and different kind of ways of working, kind of clashing during production. But it sounds like everybody actually enjoyed each other and respected each other.
I think that's right. If there were clashes, I wasn't aware of them.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of things that go on the set the directors don't know about, because nobody wants to tell the director if somebody is behaving badly, or, you know, they nobody wants to be a snitch, you know. So on every film, the director's usually pretty busy all day.
Right.
And if there are, you know, problems between the cast only come to your attention if they become a problem for the movie.
Right.
So the answer is, I don't really know, but it seemed to me they all got along really well.
Okay. I mean, you probably would have known, I'm sure.
I think I would.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain.
Right. Did you ever tell Tim Curry that, you know, I really wanted Rowan Atkinson for this? Okay.
Do you think that would have been a good idea?
It might have been a funny thing. I mean, it probably would have been funny to you, maybe not so much to him, but it might have been a funny thing.
You never say that to any actor. You know, just as John Landis didn't tell me that there'd been five previous writers on the film. So I think there was only one who got really involved, and that was Tom Stoppard. But apparently he gave up after 2 months and sent the check back.
Really? So you did what Tom Stoppard couldn't do.
Well,
that's pretty
he had
good.
I'm sure he had other fish to fry.
Right.
And I was curious. I mean, I've been writing a lot of television. I had a series, a very popular series on Britain called Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. I was writing the script actually between writing episodes of that. But I'd only written one film before, and that was 10 years earlier. And so I didn't have any reason to say no if I thought I could do it.
And we're back. We're still on the case. The mystery is still out there. Charles, how you feeling?
I feel good. You know, I mean, the it's insane that they released this movie with different endings. And then I think, as you know, he talked about this in part one, that you know, ultimately releasing it on home video with all three endings was the best way to go. And that's how I saw it for the first time. But I think it would have been so fun to see it in the theater with a different ending each time you saw it. That would have been kind of insane to see.
Yeah, but didn't he say that it was like they were all the same ending for whatever location you were at? So I guess you would have to actually physically change theaters and hope that you were getting a different one.
Yeah, and you just have to hope. Yeah, they did say that sometimes, I looked this up somewhere, they said that sometimes the listings would have, it would say with ending A, ending B, ending C. So if you were lucky at the time, I mean, it didn't do very well, so nobody did this, it's probably, but you know, you could theoretically try to seek out the other endings that you hadn't seen. And that's just that was an insane idea that I guess didn't really work at the time. But now, ultimately, putting it all together, the movie works. I mean, it's a classic. People love this movie, are obsessed with it, as I am, of course. And there's some fun things that we learned. I mean, shot on the same stage as Rear Window at Paramount, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
The Alfred Hitchcock movie Rear Window. I mean, that soundstage, that set is so iconic and amazing. And so to think of Tim Curry and this incredible cast running around on the stage there, and that's the same stage where Jimmy Stewart was doing Rear Window with Grace Kelly, and that's just awesome to think about. Alternate realities, as we always talk about, Elizabeth Taylor for Miss Scarlet and Rowan Atkinson as Wadsworth, the Tim Curry role. That's pretty...
I could see it.
Yeah, it's a cool alternative, but you know, I think we got the best version of the movie, so we're in the right timeline, you and me right now.
Oh, good.
Yeah, if you were wondering.
Well, yeah, I guess at least when it comes to Clue, that's for sure.
I also love that he showed the cast His Girl Friday, which if you have not seen that movie, it is incredible. It is such a must watch. If you haven't seen, I mean, if you're deterred by black and white movies or older movies, this movie's from 1940, it does not matter. Please watch this movie because it is the like fastest paced dialogue you will ever see in a movie. It's incredible. The movie flies by. It's so great. It's Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell, and they're both amazing in it. It's a Howard Hawks movie that is a classic, and I love that he showed the whole cast that to get them in the right headspace for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in the movie. It is really quite something.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Clue, you should also watch Clue.
That's true.
Suggestion for everybody.
You actually asked if he brought up to Tim Curry how he wanted Rowan Atkinson for the role, and Jonathan Lynn said that you never tell an actor that. So I actually had a story that a Julian Sands story that I wanted to tell, if you would indulge me.
Of course.
Julian Sands, who just recently tragically passed away, he was the lead role. Well, it was sort of co-lead. It was a bit of an ensemble, but the co-lead of this movie that I did for Hulu and Blumhouse called A Nasty Piece of Work. And he was amazing to work with. He was so fun. But the writer of the movie, Paul Soder, he's a member of Broken Lizard. He wrote the movie for Brian Cox, and he had a relationship with Brian Cox because Brian had appeared in, I think it was Super Troopers, right?
Right.
So the movie's written for Brian Cox, but like you said, you don't tell an actor. So nobody told, you know, Brian Cox couldn't do the movie. It didn't work out. He couldn't make it work schedule wise. And so, you know, we made our list of who we wanted to cast, and Julian Sands was at the top of the list, and it was like, oh my gosh, he was the first person we offered, the only person we offered. He got the role, did it. And I didn't tell him, like Jonathan Lynn said, you don't tell the actor that it's written for somebody else, or it was, you know, you wanted somebody else or anything like that. But we're you know, a week into shooting, whatever it was, we're shooting a scene where Julian's got to pass out drinks everywhere. He's got to like pour drinks. He's doing dialogue and pouring drinks and handing out drinks to like six different people. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, take after take doing that. And it's like, you know, it takes some juggling. And he comes up to me after, you know, we did it. He nailed it in like a couple of takes. And so he comes up to me after a take, and he says, "Let's see Brian Cox do that."
Wow.
So I don't know how he, someone told him, someone, I don't know, you know, like you said, Jonathan Lynn's not, you're not supposed to know who was rolling. But Julian Sands is like, yeah, you know, let's see if Brian Cox can do that.
Wow.
And I cracked up so hard. I had no idea that he knew from somewhere that Brian Cox was who it was written
for. Wow. That is amazing. R.I.P. Julian Sands.
Yes. Rest in peace. Love you, Julian. Oh, man. It was a pleasure to work with him. He's a legend. Anyway, yeah, I just thought that story reminded me. When you asked him about that, it reminded me of that.
That's so funny.
So anyway, that's it. That's all I got for this week. Clue is available on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital, and you should get it. And, of course, we are going to do a giveaway again on our social media, which Drew will tell you about our social media in a second. But the giveaway we are going to do is actually the Shout Factory 4K UHD of Clue that you and I have mentioned before that we love.
The hotly anticipated and sought after Shout Factory 4K of Clue.
Yeah, wait, is that sold out?
It was. I think it's back now, but there was a period where you could not get it at all. And I also wanted to tell people, Charles, that it's also available to stream right now on Paramount Plus. So please do that.
Awesome.
Yeah. We want to encourage everyone to like, subscribe, rate, and review this show wherever you're listening to it. And as Charles suggested, follow us on social media at Light the Fuse Pod for a chance to win that 4K UHD disc, which is a dynamo of a disc, we should say.
Yes.
And yes, we'll be back next week with part two with Jonathan Lynn. So come on back.
Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, is produced by Charles Hood. That's me and Drew Taylor. Our supervising producer is Abby Smith. This episode was edited by Luke Burson with music by Kevin Blumenfeld. This podcast is a production of Paramount Pictures. All rights are reserved.